Welcome to the Bible study. We are smack in the middle of the book of Exodus. And we're going to be in the middle of all kinds of things before we get through this morning's discussion. I'm really happy to discover that the text is doing its work. Yesterday, all the way from dish team to hiking trails, I was hearing questions lurking that in as much as people appreciate the kinds of reflection you stirred about why these plagues, you know, what the plagues tell us and what we learn from them and all these kinds of things, I need to report to you there are others among us who aren't satisfied, and I could easily be among them. You know, we've got these theories, well, it's to help the Egyptians make peace with the change that's going to come, or it's to help Moses, or it's for us. And still the question lurks, why would God harden the Pharaoh's heart? And that gets even more intense today, because the hardness of Pharaoh's heart today is going to kill him. And I suspect you know that. It occurs to me that maybe there's another word we could add to what's been part of our central discussion, and that would be the word only. We've been talking about power, you know, Pharaoh seeking power and Moses feeling powerless and who's got the power. And we so glibly kind of say this is about God asserting God's power and people learning to live in and trust and follow that power. But what happens when we put the word only in there? People learning to trust only that power. I'm not sure that the plagues help us trust that power. I am sure the plagues push us. They push our understanding. They push the narrowness of the space, of the intensity of the why. And I think they're very helpful when life is pushing. I mean, probably the only thing that's more mysterious to me than that this many plagues would happen is that they would be preserved with as much detail as they're preserved. And maybe the reason they were is because they keep feeding that deeper why question. Somebody at 7:45 told me that there are others who say, you know, I really prefer New Testament Bible study. I don't blame you. But on that level, I'd be quick to say that the center of the New Testament is why the cross. The cross is the plague of the New Testament. The central event of the New Testament in the same way that the Passover of Egypt. I mean, the two are even connected ritually. And it's just as intense. And the sad thing, I think, is that the cross has been so romanticized and sentimentalized and accommodated and domesticated that we don't hear its edges as sharply as we hear the edges of frogs in your bread bowl. You know, frogs in the bread bowl help us hear it. You know, power is awry and a change is needed much more sharply. But the push to trust only the power of God is there at Golgotha just as sharply. And the interesting thing about the New Testament, like the Exodus, is that it's there for the people who are crucifying Jesus as well as for those who are there to grieve. Why and what's happening? I mean, how they alike come to this recognition. And so today, the interesting movement that happens in the text is we'll still get to have some discussion about whether or not the Pharaoh has a change of heart. But the text will move us on to question whether the Israelites have a change of heart. They are free. Will they live like free people? And we'll listen for that. Okay, turn to chapter 12, verse 29. Well, no, let's start with 26. Yesterday we read some parts of chapter 12, just enough to to help us appreciate that before Passover even happens, the ritual is commanded. The concern is there that it will be remembered. And that's why I love 26, some of the rubrics from the rite. And when your children say to you, "What do you mean by this service?" We do these actions so that children will stir the question, "What does this mean?" You shall say, "It is the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover, for he passed over the houses of the people of Israel in Egypt, when he slew the Egyptians but spared our houses." And the people bowed their heads and worshipped. Then the people of Israel went and did so, as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. At midnight the Lord smote all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the cattle. And Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants, and all the Egyptians. And there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where one was dead. And Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron by night and said, "Rise up, go forth from among my people, both you and the people of Israel, and go serve the Lord as you have said. Take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and be gone, and bless me also." I think it's a poignant, wonderful statement of the Pharaoh, "and bless me also." Remember when the plague started, the Lord said that the Egyptians would know God, would come to know the God of the Israelites. The thing that lurks here is, does the "bless me also" demonstrate that the Pharaoh now recognizes this God, knows this God? If he does, then it's really dreadful that he's going to die in the next chapter. Or is it a cry of desperation? Not so much change of heart as desperate grief. For the Pharaoh, it is, of course, the loss of a son. That's desperate enough. But for him, it's the loss of a dynasty. And his dynasty has now been undone in the death of his son. So it's an urgent, whether you hear it as a pathetic or an admirable cry, certainly, at least the change that needs to happen to say, "Let the people go. The oppression is now broken." Comments? Questions? Discussions? One of the things that's really interesting to me is the sparsity of the text in actually describing the deliverance. We had about this much description of God attempting to persuade Moses to take the call, right? And we had this much description of the plagues. And then we're going to get about this much of actually leaving Egypt, which is interesting to me, if the book is about a change of circumstance or if fundamentally it's about some other kind of change. We like to think that if the circumstances change, then we'll be different. Right? I'm wondering about that. And the Egyptians were urgent with the people to send them out of the land in haste, for they said, "We are all dead." So the people took their dough before it was leavened, their kneading bowls being bound up in their mantles on their shoulders. The people of Israel had also done as Moses told them, for they had asked of the Egyptians jewelry of silver and of gold and clothing. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, so that they let them have what they asked. Thus they despoiled the Egyptians. And the people of Israel journeyed from Ramesses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, besides women and children. A mixed multitude also went up with them, and very many cattle, both flocks and herds. And they baked unleavened cakes of the dough which they had brought out of Egypt, for it was not leavened, because they were thrust out of Egypt and could not tarry. Neither had they prepared for themselves any provisions. The time that the people of Israel dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. And at the end of 430 years, on that very day, all the host of the Lord went out of the land of Egypt. It was a night of watching by the Lord to bring them out of the land of Egypt. So this same night is a watching kept to the Lord by all the people of Israel throughout all their generations. And here we go again with more rubrics for Passover rituals, for the worship that will describe it, that even as that one night was a night of watching, the night of Israel's freedom, so it's sanctified for all generations so that it will be remembered. By skipping over 13, I don't mean to suggest that it's not important. It's vitally important that it be remembered, reenacted, acted out, and reclaimed. But we want to get, we want to get to the people's panic, which Martin thinks says something about my personal life. I'm going to talk to you about that. It isn't actually too far to the people's panic. Chapter 14, verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pihahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal-Zephon. You shall encamp over against it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, 'They are entangled in the land. The wilderness has shut them in.'" Okay? They're at Holden Village. Trapped. You can get at them there. "And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord." And they did so. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people. And they said, "What is this we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us?" Yesterday there were those who asserted that the plagues were for the preparation of the Egyptians. I think that's a defensible line of reasoning. At the same time, even if they are well prepared for this, when it happens, comes the question, what have we done? I will never forget, I was comparing this to birth yesterday. When we went to the Lamaze classes, you know, pregnancy, and you watch the people who've been well-trained and they breathe just right, and still the first woman in the first labor you're watching on the film said, you know, stopped breathing, stopped focusing, everything she said, "This was a bad idea, I want to go home." The old, what have we done, kind of moment. One of the things that's so powerful to me in this chapter is the way it is one-way movement. There is no turning back for the Egyptians. I mean, they're going to pursue it forward in an effort to get it back. But it doesn't work, and there's no going back for the Israelites either. Let's hear the text say it. "What is this we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us? So he made ready his chariot and took his army with him, and took 600 picked chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt." Remember what we said about repetition? How it intensifies things that are important? All the power of Egypt is coming after them, all the power of Pharaoh, with officers over all of them. "And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel as they went forth defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, and all his horsemen and all his army, and overtook them and camped at the sea by Pihahiroth in front of Baal-Zephon. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. And they were in great fear. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, 'Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness?'" I love the sarcasm. This is something I would say. You've got Lake Chelan in front of you, and you see the Egyptian army, all those chariots coming down the road. "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt you brought us out here to die?" You don't have to go very far to get to the people's panic. Maybe the only thing scarier than oppression is freedom. What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Let us alone and let us serve the Egyptians? I challenge you to find where they said that. I don't remember it, do you?
No.
Those of you who've been here, I mean, I know we've skipped a lot of verses. But I just challenge you to find the place. You know, remember the first day I said we wanted to work that intersection between text and our lives? So one direction of that is we come to know the text, we pay attention to the text, and the more marvelous direction is when we discover the text paying attention to us, the text knowing us, knowing even the capacity of people to think they remember things different than they really were. Any of you discover that capacity in people? Isn't it marvelous that the text knows that about people? Knows that about hearts? I mean, that if maybe in the Pharaoh we encounter hardness of hearts, in the Egyptian or in the Israelites, we got these mushy hearts, these hearts that just collapse. And it's hard to blame them for that. I mean, they are, after all, against the water, and you know, between the water and the army is a very narrow place. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. Like I said, maybe the only thing scarier than oppression is freedom. And Moses said to the people, "Fear." This is the Charlton Heston line. "Fear not, stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be still." Fear not, it's Moses' moment. And then the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me?" I have only to wonder what happened between those verses. What I picture is something profoundly nonverbal. You know, that Moses gives this great speech to the people and then turns to God and says, you know? Go ahead.
I just want to, I have from the Living Bible, and that verse 15. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Quit praying and get the people moving.'"
And isn't it just like when you say to your kids, "It's going to be just fine inside your chest"? I imagine seeing a bear with them on the trail. I say, "Don't panic." Can't you just picture Moses in this spot? And it's such an interesting verse from God, on the lips of God, because it's so much more common for God to be saying, "Cry to me. Come to me for help." I mean, in chapter 2, when we had that, and the people of Israel groaned under their bondage, and their cry came up to God, and God heard, and God remembered, and God saw, and God knew. It was like, finally, they know there is another power. Well, this is the next of that. That knowing there is another power is to act on that power. "Tell the people of Israel to go forward. Lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, that the people of Israel may go on dry ground through the sea. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen." Then the angel of God, who went before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was the cloud and the darkness. And the night passed without one coming near the other all night. I'm really grateful that the text pays attention to these in-between times. I mean, so many times when we read the miracles of the scripture, our reading them happens so quickly that we miss the in-between times. Imagine that night, the stillness of that night, the water before you, and the pillar of cloud and fire now behind you to hold the Egyptians at bay. I mean, you talk about Lamaze. I mean, I really am grateful to Lamaze. The only advice as a pastor I give anymore is keep breathing. But I'm not sure I'd be able even to say it that night. Keep breathing all night as you wait. I'm really grateful that the text pays attention, even in that little paragraph, to that in-betweenness. Okay? I mean, there were some people I talked to recently trying to remember where their church burned. It was an arson on Saturday. It was done on a Saturday night. And they worshiped on Sunday morning in the parking lot with the firefighters behind them fighting the fire. And by the next Sunday, that must have been somebody in the village.
No, it was at the campground.
It was at the campground. Okay, that's right. By the next Sunday, the neighboring congregation offered them their space. So they just moved down the street into the next congregation. And worship continued. They said, we never missed a beat. It was sort of interesting. Then they built a different style sanctuary and had to deal with their grief then when they got into the new sanctuary. It didn't fit. You know, that was the description. But I think about those moments. You know, your church is burning. And you're standing in the parking lot worshiping. Because it's what the church is. What the people of God are. And that the text will pay attention to the honesty of a movement of God that's got these spaces in it that put us in between. I think that's a gift. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And in the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of fire and of cloud looked down upon the host of the Egyptians and discomfited the host of the Egyptians, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. It may be pushing this metaphorically, but it's kind of marvelous. You know, the Israelites have been stuck in the mud for 400 years. That's how you make bricks in the ancient world. The tables get turned, and now the mud surrounds the Egyptians. This is that turning moment. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and upon their horsemen. So Moses stretched forth his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its wonted flow when the morning appeared, and the Egyptians fled into it. And the Lord routed the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea. Not so much as one of them remained. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore. And Israel saw the great work which the Lord did against the Egyptians. And the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. The Lord saved the Israelites. One of the reasons I love the book, and I especially love the chapter, is it makes it so clear that salvation is a movement. And if the water went down over the Egyptians, it also went down behind the Israelites. And there is no turning back now. They are free by the power of God. For all that means, there is no turning back. First of all, I think that's just truthful about life. I'm grateful for daily worship. I love the rhythm of daily worship, and I love evening worship for the truthfulness with which it says, the day is over. The day is done. The waters are shut on the day. But in another sense, I want to capture the drama of this movement because it's so important for the way it says freedom is different than oppression. There's a movement between the two. They are not the same thing. Salvation is a movement. I like to say the church is a movement of the people of God. Gerhard Frost has a wonderful poem about the unfortunate vision of God sitting on a throne. Because he says, if God is sitting, we end up with entirely too many people sitting. The church is not sitting. It is moving. It's people moving behind the action of God. And that is never more important than when we're talking about forgiveness. You've no doubt garnered from my illustrations that I've learned a ton from teaching confirmation. Confirmants are very straightforward and blunt, and if you listen to them, you learn a lot from them. And so I insist now that definitions of forgiveness include a movement word. Because the problem is, people end up thinking of forgiveness as meaning it's okay to do something wrong. That's like saying, it's okay to live in oppression. It's okay to be stuck in the mud. I submit to you, in terms of the story, that is not okay. It was not okay for the Israelites. It was not okay for the Pharaoh. And it was not okay for God. And God, with some drama and force, moved the people. So I resist definitions, understandings of forgiveness that suggest that we can be estranged. And that forgiveness happens up here somewhere, right? That it somehow changes something up there, Carol, in the sky. And we can still be mad and guilted and not, you know, all those kinds of things. That is not forgiveness. Forgiveness is a movement. And the Red Sea would have us say, even a movement from which there is no turning back. A movement toward each other with a commitment that says there's no going back. The oppression is drowned. The guilt is drowned. The wrong is drowned. That's why we go here for baptismal imagery. A wonderful baptismal imagery. Comments, questions, discussion? Go ahead.
Part significant then that it was a wind that parted the sea. You don't have wind without movement.
That's right.
And baptism is the spirit, the wind.
As a prairie person, I appreciate you saying that. I love to say the prairie produces sturdy people. when you lean into the wind all your life, it makes, and the word is the same in the Bible for wind and spirit. Movement. You can't even say it without thinking movement. So hardness of heart then becomes resistance to that movement. And what we hear is the singularity of the power to move people. Go ahead.
So by what you're saying, forgiveness can only happen when there is true repentance or turning away from. Unless you turn away from it, you can't be forgiven.
I would rather articulate it in terms of the turning toward. That what I'm saying is that the movement of God is a movement toward, we're wanting to say, freedom. Okay? Turning toward new life. And what I'm resisting is what Bonhoeffer identified as a kind of cheap grace that doesn't see much difference between oppression and freedom. See? There doesn't seem much difference between death and life. I hear the text articulating that, at least circumstantially, as very different. So that the movement toward God is a movement toward neighbor, even the one that's wronged you. Because God is mercy, forgiveness, life. And that is the power which is moving us.
I heard a 4th of July sermon some years ago that said freedom is the ultimate slavery.
Freedom is the ultimate slavery.
And he was talking about the United States and that we had all this freedom, but we also had the ultimate obligation to maintain it. And so we couldn't let go of that.
Luther's phrase is bound to be free. That inasmuch as we are bound to the power of God, that much we are free. And you see, I hear in that not Independence Day, but Dependence Day. Right? Our utter dependence on the power of God alone to move. I mean, that's where I hear the text pushing us. Now, why the text does all that it does. The only thing more amazing maybe did I say this already? I said it at 7:45. If I said it already here. That the plagues happened is that they're remembered and retold and written down in all this detail for all this time. You might think it's hard to get people to move. And, I mean, the other thing that I said, I know I said yesterday, is that the story isn't over. Exodus has 40 chapters. We're only on chapter 14, which is why the title says Freedom from Slavery. What's the freedom for? The next thing the text gives us to look at is whether the people have changed. Okay? Well, for a moment, we'll get there. And then let's turn to chapter 15. Then Moses and the people of Israel sang this song to the Lord, saying, I will sing to the Lord, for God has triumphed gloriously. The horse and rider God has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song, and God has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise my Father's God. And I will exalt. Okay? Miriam adds some other dimensions to the worship of Israel. And this is just in the rhythm of the book. We've heard it before. There's an announcement and the people worship. There's an action and the people worship. Well, now there's action and the people worship. So Miriam, it says, verse 20, then Miriam, the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took a timbrel. That's a hand drum in her hand, just in case there's ever any discussion in your church about drums in worship, this is a helpful verse to know. And all the women went out after her with timbrels and dancing. There may get to be discussion about dancing too. And Miriam saying to them, "Sing to the Lord, for God has triumphed gloriously. The horse and rider, God is thrown into the sea." The thing I want to say is that the action of God isn't complete until it's worshiped, until somebody sings a song about it, or dances a dance in it, or paints a picture of it. A meal is not complete until somebody says, "Thank you. It was wonderful." Okay? That the action of God takes up the action of people in song and in dance, in gratitude and in exaltation. It's the power of poetry that helps us see. A couple days ago, I was wanting to say the problem with oppression is in our eyes. And the power of praise is new eyes to see a greater power and to say it out loud. So somebody at 7:45 said, well, the problem with Lutheran worship is that in the old days, he said, it became a spectator sport. Well, when that happens, we've got to go to the older days. Okay, the days before the old days when that happened. Rationalism made it largely verbal, an exchange of words. Thankfully, the liturgy preserved all kinds of other pieces, changes of color, changes of action. Good worship touches all the senses, makes all the senses aware that God has done something, and we're caught up in this action. It is all of our action. So in the olden days, we want to remember, worship was among people who were largely illiterate. It didn't matter what page they were on in the book, they couldn't read it anyway. They knew it by heart, and they could participate in it because of the repetition of the action. It was their worship. And I still believe the most powerful words are the words we know by heart and are able to say without thinking. I don't think that diminishes liturgy. I think that deepens it. And we've got this happening here. Every time something happens, the people worship. The text is asserting, I think, that the action of God is not complete until people are caught up in it, singing it, rejoicing in it, being grateful for it, painting it, dancing it. It has a rhythm. Rhythm helps us do it together. That's why drums can be real important in worship. And rhythm is important in worship, whether you use drums or not. Because the beat helps us stay together. Comments? Questions? After I refuted the 7:45 comment, you're scared. Just one other little thing I want to point out from chapter 15 in verse 15. Now the chiefs of Edom are the chiefs of Edom dismayed. The leaders of Moab trembling seizes them. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. If you know your biblical geography, you've got a real important clue there. The people aren't anywhere close to Canaan. They're out on the Sinai Peninsula. What's this verse doing here? Well, it snuck in to demonstrate that the people of Israel kept singing this song long after they left the Sinai Peninsula, when they faced other powers, other oppression. Okay? Then the song of God's power and God's deliverance moved them on. The historians document that the Edomites and the Moabites didn't inhabit the Canaan until long after the Exodus. So what we have here is an addition that simply says the song is sung through centuries. The memory sustains the power in worship to keep the people facing.
Yeah, the people of Philistia reference too.
Yes.
In verse 14. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Just because I'm not a biblical scholar by any means, how far did they have to go? What was the distance?
Oh, it's a long way. I'm trying to remember because we didn't take the trip when we were in Israel, but today to go from Jerusalem to Egypt across the Sinai Peninsula on bus would be a very, very long day, day's drive, like 12 hours, something like that.
Like here to hold the mic and back? Or?
Yeah. 40 years. You know, that's more like. That's what we say for a long, long. Okay. So we've watched the power of God move the circumstances, right? Move the people. Change the Pharaoh's heart, albeit hardened to the end. Defeat the hardness of heart, finally. How do you suppose we'll find the Israelite heart? Let's turn to chapter 16. They set out from Elam, and all the congregation of the people of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elam and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. About 6 weeks. Okay? And the whole congregation of the people of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness and said to them, "Would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." In my fantasies, I would like to believe that if I had seen that sea, those walls of water, if it could have been my privilege to walk through on dry land but between the walls of water, that never again would I doubt the power of God. That's what I want to believe. The text will not let me believe that. It says about 6 weeks later, you may run out of cereal. And or coffee. That would be worse. That would be worse. It will be morning, and you will be mad. And my favorite metaphor in all the world for nostalgia are these flesh pots of Egypt. Lusting after the flesh pots of Egypt. I think it's marvelous poetry, again, for what the text knows about people and their capacity to remember things with sort of tints of rose around them, and then to diminish the present moment because of it. It's not just that they remember, but they get so torqued about being in this present circumstance for them. And so now we encounter the Israelites' heart. And the rest of the book will be about their hearts and their freedom and whether they're willing to live in their freedom. See, the other thing that's so powerful about this is the way it brings social justice kind of realm into the breakfast realm. Okay? The daily bread realm. Where do we live our freedom? In daily life, with basic necessities. The text has already gotten us there, because now the people are stuck there in a panic over. Well, let's read how God responds to this. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. So Moses and Aaron said to all the people of Israel, at evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your murmurings against the Lord. For what are we that you murmur against us? And Moses said, when the Lord gives you in the evening flesh to eat, and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your murmurings, which you murmur against him, what are we? Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, say to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your murmurings. And as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the people of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness. Behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the murmurings of the people of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat flesh, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God. In the evening, quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning dew lay round about the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as hoarfrost on the ground. When the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather it, every one of you, as much as you can eat. You shall take an omer apiece according to the number of persons whom each of you has in his tent. And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, he that gathered much had nothing over, and she that gathered little had no lack. Each gathered according to what they could eat. And Moses said to them, let no one leave any of it till the morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and became foul. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as they could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted. On the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, two omers apiece. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over lay by to be kept till the morning. So they laid it by till the morning, as Moses bade them, and it did not become foul, and there were no worms in it. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none. On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, and they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, God gives you bread for 2 days. Remain every one of you in place. Let no one go out of place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. Now the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like coriander seed, white. And the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. And Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generations, that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer of manna in it, and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. And the people of Israel ate the manna 40 years till they came to a habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. An omer is the 10th part of an ephah. I knew you were all wondering. And what is an omer? An omer is enough. For those who have more in their tent, it's a little more. And for those who have not quite so many, It isn't quite so much. Perfect. Enough. One of my favorite scenes in all of literature is in Dickens' A Christmas Carol, when the ghost of Christmas Present says to Scrooge, "I'm going to take you to the poor houses." And Scrooge says, "The poor, they have enough." And the ghost of Christmas Present throws back his head and laughs and laughs and laughs and says, "Enough, enough. A wonderful word, enough." What is freedom? Oh, one of the definitions we get is it's enough, okay? What is freedom? It is a day at a time. One day at a time, that's enough, and that's freedom. You hear God training the people to be free and making it utterly clear, first, that freedom will come on God's terms. God will provide the day and food for the day. And the other thing you hear is that the text knows about people who will check it out at every turn. Don't keep any over. So they keep some over and it is foul. But keep it over on the sixth, and it will sixth day it will not grow foul, so that it provides for you on the seventh. Don't go look for it on the seventh. But they gotta go check. I think it's hard to be free. What are they freed for? Chapter 15, we heard they're freed for praise, for participation in, acknowledgement of, gratitude for, and reenactment of the great acts of God. Now we see they're freed for trust, even for their most basic need. One day at a time. Freed for some sharing, for some give and take. I think this is a wonderful economy. Very freeing. Everybody has enough, and none have any left over. It's really quite splendid. And I suppose we can be free enough even to celebrate that they're freed from murmuring and grumbling and panicking, and they're freed for testing and checking. I mean, the power of God is not undone by that. The freedom of the people is, but the power of God is not. Questions? Comments? Go ahead.
I think sometimes in our country, which is so bountiful, we think of freedom as having lots of options. You know, we don't just go to the little market. We go to Super Safeway, you know. Mm-hmm. You can have 50 choices of cereal or beer. And I think...
Beer?
Did somebody say a holy word?
In this case, seems like a limiting of options. If we define freedom like you got 100 options,
yeah.
But that's not really the full definition of freedom.
Freedom of choice is also burden of choice. Mm-hmm. Then you have to decide. Camping is so freeing because you can only take what you can carry, and you have to eat what you're carrying.
I was just going to say, the more stuff you have, the more you are a slave to it.
Yeah.
Like, if you have a big boat, you have to worry about where to store it and what to do with it when you're not using it, and you have to be able to build a bigger garage.
Some of us, when we go camping, carry even more, take even more than we can carry.
There was a jab. Did the right person catch it? It gets to be a real challenge, a greater challenge. Just by sheer volume of the book, a much greater challenge for God to get God's own people to live God's freedom by God's power than it was with the Egyptians. Isn't that amazing? Our presiding bishop, George Anderson, says, the question is not whether the church will survive. The question is whether we will be the church. Whether we will live out of the power of God, for the power of God, toward it, and all that it gives us. It defines it. Tomorrow we'll work on that definition. The covenant of freedom, we'll call that. Whether we will live there, or whether we'll get stuck storing our toys. And even when we recognize the oppression of them, the slavery of them, to have the courage to change it is a whole nother matter. You know, to put our feet on a different path. Any more discussion?
I'm wondering if you'd want to tie this in at all with the Lord's Prayer petition.
Absolutely. Give us this day our daily bread. The only words in the Lord's Prayer that are repeated. We've tried to say that one of the things the Bible does for emphasis is sheer repetition. The only repetition in the Lord's Prayer is the word daily. It said twice, give us this day our daily bread. So, you know, I think one of the other things that happens in our culture is that a lot of what we think is freedom gets a future focus. You know, freedom is getting a plan and then getting enough to make sure we'll be okay, and security and, you know, all of those kinds of things in place. This freedom is more limited. But it is the terms on which it is given textually, I think in many ways given experientially too. It really is the only day we have. And we don't know what tomorrow will bring. I understand the boat is fixed, but if something happens to the boat, tomorrow will be radically different for us. And we can't deal with that until tomorrow. Tomorrow, Covenant of Freedom, chapters 19 and 20. Thank you for the day.